My name is Stan Graf. I am a clinical and research psychiatrist. I was born and educated in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and I came to this country when I was 37. I came first on a scholarship, which was to Johns Hopkins, for a year, and then as I was here, it was extended for another year. And then during the second year, Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, and everybody who was outside was asked to go back, and I refused to go back. And transpersonal psychology differs from traditional psychology in what it adds to the understanding of the psyche. Transpersonal psychology includes actually traditional approaches to psychology, but it differs in its philosophy. So the best way you can describe it is to use what Frances Vaughan said. She said that what defines a transpersonal psychologist is not the content of what they work with, but their large context. You see, their model of the psyche is much larger than the traditional. Traditional psychology has a model which is limited to what we can call postnatal biography, things that happened to us after we were born. It does not include even birth, you know, which is a very important, very major event in human life. It doesn't include the prenatal experience, which we now know is very important for psychology. And it also has a very narrow understanding of what Freud described as the unconscious. Basically, stays with the Freudian understanding that the unconscious is basically a derivative of postnatal biography. It includes things that we have forgotten, that we have rejected, that we found unacceptable. It's a kind of a junkyard of rejects of individual biography, whereas the transpersonal understanding includes the collective unconscious, the way Jung described it. You know, both in the historical aspect, which means that the history of humanity is still with us, is still recorded in the collective unconscious, and it also includes what Jung would have called archetypal aspects, mythological aspects of the collective unconscious. You can say that transpersonal psychology is a system of thinking that covers the whole spectrum of human experience, which includes what we call non-ordinary states of consciousness, which means experiences, for example, that you find in shamans, in the kind of initiatory crisis, but also something that the shamans experience themselves or that they induce in their clients where they are doing healing. Non-ordinary states are also states experienced by native cultures as part of their ritual life, particularly so-called rites of passage, you know, powerful rituals enacted at the time of important transitions such as birth, circumcision, puberty, menopause, and of course dying. Those are experiences that were described by the initiates in the ancient mysteries in the Mediterranean area and elsewhere. These are experiences described by mystics of all ages, and also by yogis and by practitioners of some other spiritual disciplines, various schools of Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, you know, Christian mysticism, and so on. Now, what's I think, very specific for transpersonal psychology is that it not only studies these states, but transpersonal psychologists hold these states in great esteem, which was the case for all ancient and pre-industrial cultures, whereas traditional academic mainstream psychology, psychiatry might have studied somewhat these states, but they basically discard them as something that's pathological, that's coming out of brain pathology, something that's not useful for anything. Whereas transpersonal psychology has shown that these states are, if they're properly understood, properly supported, that they are actually healing, that they are transformative, and even in a sense evolutionary. So transpersonal psychology honors the ritual and spiritual life of other cultures that Western psychiatry and psychology tend to pathologize, and sees spirituality as a very, very important, very critical dimension, not just in the human psyche, but also in the universal scheme of things. Well, I think we can look at the history of 20th century psychology, where the first half of it was really dominated by two schools, primarily by behaviorism and by Freudian psychoanalysis. Behaviorism is something that came out of the work of the Nobel Prize winning Russian physiologist Ivan Petrovich Pavlov, and also the work of John Watson. It's a system of psychology that basically wanted to use as more or less exclusive source of data behavior, which is, you know, observable behavior, and exclude any kind of introspective data, exclude consciousness, something very, very uniquely human. And Freudian psychoanalysis, you know, is based on the work of Freud and his followers, which had to do primarily with the discovery of the unconscious, that we just, the psyche is not limited to our conscious processes, but there is this very important domain that in ordinary life has a very strong influence over us, but becomes remains unconscious. And then also the discovery that Freud made of the extent to which we are influenced by very early memories of our life, right? What happened in infancy, in childhood, not just in later life. So in the middle of the 20th century, there was increasing dissatisfaction with the limitations of these two schools that dominated Western psychology. And the main spokesman of this movement became Abraham Maslow, a very, very well-known American psychologist. And he formulated very, very sharp criticism of both behaviorism and Freudian psychoanalysis. His main objection against behaviorism was that it was drawing its information exclusively from the work with animals, primarily rats and pigeons. And his objection was that by studying rats and pigeons, you can learn about just about the functions that we share with these animals. And there's no way you can use that information to understand some of the higher psychological functions and your specifically human characteristics, ethics, aesthetics, you know, art, literature, science, religion. He also objected against the fact that behaviorism left out introspection and consciousness as areas of study. As far as psychoanalysis is concerned, his main objection was that the information for creating theories in psychoanalysis come primarily from emotional disorders, from psychosomatic disorders, from the realm of psychopathology. And he emphasized that psychology should be also studying not only normal people, quote unquote, but also what he called the growing tip of a population, which means people who have extraordinary functioning in a variety of areas. He is well known for his study of several hundred people who had what he called peak experiences, you know, states of unity with other people, with nature, with the cosmos. He called them peak experiences. And he showed that that approach of traditional psychiatry that sees these states as essentially psychotic is incorrect, that these experiences happen in people who don't show any signs of pathology otherwise. And if they properly integrate these states, that these states actually move them toward what he called self-actualization, self-realization. And that people discover within themselves higher values that he called meta-values, the genuine sense for justice, genuine sense of beauty and goodness and so on. Whereas in traditional psychology, these phenomena like beauty and love and justice are seen as reaction formations, basically against negative characteristics. So he and Antoni Sutic launched a new school in psychology that they call the third force, behaviorism and Freudian psychoanalysis being the first and the second forces. And they called it humanistic psychology. Now, humanistic psychology very, very rapidly became popular, both among professionals and also laymen. There were many workshops, many conferences, you know, well attended by people. Esalen started the Esalen Institute in Big Sur that became like a mecca of this new human potential movement. And humanistic psychology created a kind of an umbrella under which many new therapies developed. Therapies that were called experiential because they were not limited to verbal exchanges like psychoanalysis or behaviorism, but emphasized direct work with emotions and also somehow transcended the taboo against touching, which you find in psychoanalysis, and emphasize somehow the unity of the psyche and the body, and introduce a variety of physical interventions as an integral part of therapy. Now, in spite of the fact that there was such general acceptance, enthusiastic acceptance of humanistic psychology, the founders, Abraham Maslow and Tony Sutic, actually were not satisfied with what they had created. They realized within a few years that they left out a very important dimension in human psychology, which was spirituality. That even humanistic psychology did not really include the kind of knowledge that comes from mystical traditions, the kind of knowledge that comes from meditation, that didn't really treat adequately some of the highest human values. And so they started thinking about creating yet another movement in psychology, the fourth force. They started meeting in a very small group with a few people in Palo Alto. And this is where I became part of this group. I was at that time working in Maryland at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, but I was also coming frequently to the Esalen Institute to do workshops. And Paul Herbert, who was the chronicler at Esalen, he was recording all these different workshops. When he heard my material, he said, you should meet Abraham Maslow because, you know, he is talking about very similar kinds of things. only his data come from people who had spontaneous mystical experiences. You're talking about people who had experiences induced by psychedelic substances, but there's tremendous overlap, as I can tell, Paul said. And so he gave me Abe Maslow's address, and I sent him a large manuscript summarizing the findings of our research in Europe, a manuscript that has never been published. It then later became five books, you know, expanded into five books. But I sent that to Abe Maslow, and I got a very enthusiastic response and an invitation to come and see him in Boston. He was actually recovering after a heart attack. So I was invited into this small group that was formulating these principles of the new psychology of the fourth force. Now, Abe and Tony wanted to call this psychology transhumanistic, going even beyond humanistic psychology. And then they looked at what I have written about the experiences in psychedelic sessions, where I talk about three levels of experience: biographical, perinatal, focusing on reliving of birth and prenatal life. And then I described a large group of experiences, or even a level in the unconscious that I called transpersonal. And so they got very excited about this term transpersonal and moved from transhumanistic to transpersonal. Now, there was a very interesting relationship between this new psychology, transpersonal psychology, and traditional science. We were very excited about what we created in psychology, because we felt that we created psychology that was very culturally sensitive, that was treating with respect and appropriate attention the ritual and the spiritual traditions of the world, that it sort of overcame somehow what we considered to be a major error of psychiatry and psychology, which was pathologizing spirituality, sort of seeing anybody who is spiritual as showing lack of education, lack of knowledge of the scientific understanding of the world, somebody who is childish and gullible and superstitious, somebody who's into primitive thinking, and anybody who has a mystical spiritual experience is labeled as psychotic. So we felt transpersonal psychology resolved this major deficit in traditional psychiatry and psychology. We also felt that it was important that transpersonal psychology responded to the observations from modern consciousness research, which were paradigm breaking, the studies of thanatology, of psychedelic research, what was coming out of experiential psychotherapists, even things that were coming from field anthropology and so on, that we really treated the observations and experiences from non-ordinary states the way they should be treated, as paradigm challenges. And we felt that transpersonal psychology was kind of logically consistent and was coherent in and of itself. But the major problem was the tremendous gap that was between transpersonal psychology and what was seen as the scientific worldview, which is what Fritjof Capra called the Cartesian Newtonian worldview. There was a problem with transpersonal psychology because it seemed to be in unresolvable conflict with traditional science. It was very vulnerable to attacks of being labeled as irrational, as unscientific, and even flaky, in spite of the fact that it involved people with good academic credentials. And so what became very exciting for me when I met Fritjof Capra shortly after his book The Tao of Physics was published was showing that physics, was developed, Fritjof showed that somehow the development in a variety of sciences, you know, biology, medicine, certainly psychiatry, psychology, was really a derivative of Newtonian mechanistic thinking. And that physicists themselves in the 20th century have transcended every single aspect of Newtonian, Cartesian thinking about the physical universe. But what was happening in these other disciplines, they stayed in the 17th century. They didn't catch up. So they were still sort of developing their ideas as if the world was the 17th century Newtonian Cartesian world. And Fritjof showed to what extent actually the thinking in quantum relativistic physics was now rapidly converging with the thinking in Eastern philosophies and also in the mystical traditions. So Fritjof and I became good friends, and we started doing seminars together, one-day seminars called Journeys Beyond Space and Time, when Fritjof would take the morning and tell people what quantum relativistic physics discovered about the universe. And when lunch came, people's minds were completely blown, because at that point, you know, there was Big Bang, there was the origin of the universe out of singularity, where time and space was created, and you know, out of this dimensionless point, all the matter that now constitutes the billions of galaxies was created. There were black holes, white holes, wormholes. People were getting Nobel Prize for finding out that particle going forward in space is really an antiparticle going backwards in space. So when people came from lunch after Fritjof's morning, you know, what I was presenting was fairly sober. And so this was just the beginning, you know, the philosophical implications of quantum relativistic physics. But there were discoveries in biology, Rupert Sheldrake, the concept of morphogenetic fields and morphogenetic resonance, and David Bohm's theory of holo movement, you know, holographic thinking, created tremendous excitement, and together with Carl Pribram's holographic model of the brain, and later Prigozhin's concept of dissipative structure scheme and chaos theory and so on. And what has been extremely exciting is that all these advances in what we now call the new paradigm always represented an embarrassment for traditional academic thinking, but they were always welcomed by the transpersonal circles as new pieces in a mosaic of something that hopefully will be a new comprehensive worldview of which transpersonal psychology would be a really integral part. I was working at the Department of Psychiatry of the School of Medicine in Prague, and we just were finishing a large study of Melaril, one of the early tranquilizers. So it was a very exciting era. People believed that all problems in psychiatry would be eventually solved, you know, pharmacologically. And this Melaril came from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company from Switzerland. So we had a very good working relationship with them. And one day, the department when I was working got a large box of ampules from Sandoz, and a letter came with it. And the letter said this was a very exciting investigational new substance that was discovered, or the effects of which were discovered practically by accident by Dr. Hoffman, the leading chemist in the laboratories, when he accidentally intoxicated himself as he was synthesizing the substance. It's called LSD-25. Dr. Hoffman's boss had a son who was a psychiatrist, Dr. Stoll, and he conducted a pilot study with a group of quote-unquote normal people and also some psychiatric patients, and published a paper which overnight became a sensation in the scientific world. And now Sandoz was sending samples to different research institutes, clinics, universities, and also to individual therapists And they were asking, you know, would we work with it? And would we give them feedback whether there is some legitimate use for this substance in psychiatry? And in the letter they mentioned two things. The first one was that they believed on the basis of this pilot study that LSD can produce in incredibly minute dosages of millions of a gram very profound changes of mental functioning that seem to bear some similarity to what we see in naturally occurring psychosis. So they were offering it as a model that we could study. We could give it to, again, so-called normal volunteers, do all kinds of tests before, during, and after, and we would get a sense of what's happening biologically when this mental functioning is so profoundly changed. And it's always useful when you have a model in psychiatry. And then there was a little note which kind of became my destiny. It said that they also feel that LSD could be used as a kind of unconventional educational training tool for psychiatrists, for psychologists, that they could take it and spend a few hours in the world of their patients, and as a result of it be able to communicate with them better, to understand them better, and hopefully to be more effective in treating them. So I wouldn't have missed this for anything in the world. I kind of, you know, became one of the early volunteers, and I had an experience that just really changed my life, both professionally and personally. It's going to be soon half a century when I had this experience, and since that time I have really done very little professionally that would not be related in one way or another to these non-ordinary states. It's about half of the time was clinical research with psychedelics, first in Prague in the Psychiatric Research Institute, and then in Maryland, the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, where for several years I was actually heading that research. It was the last surviving research in the United States. And then the second half was a combination of working with holotropic breathwork, which was a non-pharmacological method, experiential method of self-exploration and therapy that Christina and I developed, where you use a combination of faster breathing, powerful evocative music, and a certain kind of body work. And people have very, very similar types of experiences, covering basically the same kind of a spectrum. And then I spent also, and Christina too, quite a bit of time working with people who had spontaneous episodes of non-ordinary states. And, you know, as a result of our experiences with psychedelics and then this holotropic breathwork, we came to the conclusion that these states actually have, if they're properly understood, properly supported, that they have healing potential, that they have transformative potential, evolutionary potential. And we coined for them the term spiritual emergency, sort of, that those are really crises of spiritual opening. And if you support them, that people move out of the materialistic worldview to a worldview that incorporates spirituality, universal, ecumenical, kind of all-embracing spirituality. So those were my experiences, which were, you know, direct work with people. And then I was also involved in many, or have been involved in many areas. But the common denominator always is non-ordinary states. I spent a lot of time with shamans, Native American shamans, Mexican shamans, South American shamans. We visited also the shaman in both the Ainu people in northern Japan. I participated in native ceremonies, you know, with peyote, with mushrooms, with ayahuasca. Kava in Fiji. I was very interested in people having near-death experiences. Spent a lot of time with thanatologists also. And we ourselves had a large study using LSD therapy with terminal cancer patients, seeing if we can influence somehow the attitude towards death and transform the the process of dying through mystical experiences. This was probably the most interesting, the most moving work that I've ever been involved in. There was about one-third of the patients who were seen as essentially, I would say about one-third dramatically improved, one-third with sort of moderate improvements, and then there was one-third when there were no major changes that we could detect. And also, as far as the pain is concerned, it was not like an analgesic. It was not absolutely predictable. It was not dose-related. It didn't happen to everybody, but when it happened, which was in a significant number of people, it was very, very dramatic. It was basically showing that pain is a very complex phenomenon. It's not just that there is a tissue irritation and then, you know, it's taken to the brain, and then there's a response to the brain, to the pain going into the periphery. It seemed that pain was a very, very, you know, complex phenomenon. We used Melzack's theory of gait control when he talks about the different components that are involved in pain, where this tissue irritation and the signal is just one part of it. And then you have things like your whole history of pain, kind of a programming. There are cultural factors that go into it, like, you know, Native Americans who participate in the Sundance, when they get the skewers through the pectoral muscles, have a little different attitude toward pain that people in our culture, who think you have to run into the pharmacy if you have a headache, get your Buffarin and so on. So it's a very complex phenomenon, and it seemed that that very complex response to LSD interacted, you know, in some interesting way with this complex phenomenon of pain, and sometimes created very, very impressive results. The changes in cancer patients were quite dramatic. I mean, there's no talking therapy that can come close. And certainly, you cannot very profoundly influence pain intractable by narcotics by talking about it. And it would be very difficult to talk people out of fear of death. You have to have a pretty impressive, profound experience for that to happen. We had some very, very dramatic results in a group of alcoholics in a study which was with narcotic drug addicts. So, for example, with the alcoholics, we had a 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months follow-up. There was 52% of the patients, and these were very, very disturbed alcoholics from the alcoholic rehabilitation unit from the state hospital, really kind of what's called skid row cases. A team of people who were independent of the therapeutic team rated 52% of those patients as being essentially rehabilitated after 6 months. And then it went down, you know, in a year and 18 months. Also, the follow-up became a little difficult because some of the people move and you cannot locate them and so on. But this was a pretty full and reliable follow-up in 6 months. This was not just sobriety, but they were seen as rehabilitated in many other areas, social, professional, and so on. So that was quite dramatic. This was about 30% in the group of heroin addicts. Again, very, very severe narcotic addicts who were taken from prison because they were there for prostitution or pushing or stealing. And this study gave them the option to spend the rest of the sentence at home, but they had to come afterward. They had to come every day to give a sample of urine so that we would know day by day whether they were, you know, taking it or firing or whatever. And one-third of these patients were seen as rehabilitated and at 6 months. So usually 94% of these patients would be back on the street. It's a little less dramatic in neurotic patients. We were limited. We couldn't give more than 3 sessions. And it seemed that the alcoholics and the heroin addicts and even people dying of cancer are more prone to this kind of a dramatic conversion or kind of a spiritual opening that various categories of neurotic patients. For example, obsessive-compulsive patients are very controlled, very rigid, don't respond, you know, as readily to this kind of therapy as do, for example, alcoholics or heroin addicts. Well, there are basically 2 different approaches. One that we did mostly in Europe, which was called psycholytic therapy, which was a whole series of sessions, but the dosages were smaller, so it was kind of an extension of psychoanalysis. It was like LSD-assisted psychoanalysis. And the second one was called psychedelic, where you use a very large dose. You use the sessions are strictly internalized with eye shades, with headphones. And the emphasis then is on a sort of a powerful, deep kind of transformation that comes through spiritual opening. So rather than sort of this gradual exploration of the psyche that reminiscent somehow of psychoanalysis, one of my clients called it the onion peeling of the unconscious. You go layer after layer. The psychedelic therapy really reaches very deep into the psyche and induces an experience, you know, which can change people in an afternoon. So I experienced both in and actually kind of an in-between as well. In Europe, I started from the extension of psychoanalysis, you know, adding dosages like from maybe 100 to 200, 250. And then discovering that it was very useful for people to close the eyes, maybe play music, do less interaction and talking. And then when I came to the United States, our method there was the psychedelic method, where we would spend like 10, 12 hours maybe with the client in preparation, talking about the problems they're bringing into therapy, talking about their life, so we have a context for understanding the experiences. Then spending maybe 2 hours preparing them for the session itself, what kind of experiences can come up, you know, how we are going to communicate, how we are going to share the experience, and so on. And then was the session itself, where it was a full day. It usually was 8, sometimes 10 hours. We would spend most of the time with the client who had eye shades, headphones. We spend the day playing music, with minimum talking. And then maybe 5-6 hours into the session, we started interacting. We started sort of talking about what happened, helping the person to integrate it. And then a little later, we would have a reunion where people could bring their own friends, relatives of their choice. And we would have a dinner with a nice sort of carry-out, from a nice carry-out place. Something with interesting textures, colors, tastes. We would also take the person, if there was a nice day, we would take the person out, watch sunsets, you know, smell the hay if it was that time of the year, and so on. The basic idea here was to bring these new experiences and new perceptual potential down to earth, just to sort of, and the person was still in a somewhat non-ordinary, open mode of consciousness, to have them experience things that would be part of their everyday life. Connect those with music, with human interaction, with food, with appreciation of nature, and so on. So that the session does not remain sort of out there as something that's completely separate from everyday life, but becomes kind of an integral part of it. And you felt that that helps somehow to change that person's functioning in everyday life. Of course, the propaganda came, you know, when the image of LSD suddenly was dictated by journalists, and the criterion was what happened to people when they take it in the street rather than what you do when you, you know, run a responsible therapeutic experiment and so on. That was one part of it. The other part was that in these situations, the administrators and the legislators didn't want to take the responsibility. You know, they were afraid of malpractice suits, which are very, very common in this country. And we got a very strange answer when we asked for more money for the research. They said, you have already proved that, you know, it's useful. There's no reason to research it any further. That was their response. It was so impressive, and I don't see any reason why psychedelics should not be used with people who are in that kind of a crisis, when there are chances that they could be helped, you know, that the suffering could be relieved. So there's a lot of irrational stuff in this whole area. Scientific revolution, you know, that started in England 300 years ago, there was tremendous excitement about reason. For example, in the French Revolution, at one point, Notre Dame became the temple of reason rather than Mary. And so there was excitement about reason and about the achievements of reason and the technological applications of those discoveries. So that everything that was not rational was kind of rejected and was even ridiculed. But the problem is that not everything that's not rational is irrational. There are things which are trans-rational. And so the trans-rational has been sort of rejected somehow from our worldview together with the irrational. And I think a lot of the misunderstanding is this kind of a confluence in popular understanding between the transrational and the irrational, a sort of inability to really distinguish that. Ken Wilber talked about the pre-trans fallacy, you know, what is pre-rational, what is trans-rational, what is pre-personal, what is transpersonal. We have seen it in transpersonal conferences, you know, that on one hand it attracts a lot of avant-garde scientists, including physicists, astrophysicists, biologists, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, but it also brings in a lot of people who might be even borderline. And we have seen it in the area of spiritual emergency, that when the problem of Western psychiatry is pathologization of the spiritual, of the transpersonal, there are some other circles which might glorify pathology. And it's not always sort of easy, you know, to discriminate between those two. So there's a tendency to reject this kind of non-rational domain without differentiation. You know, for example, confusing some kind of a popular superstition, folk beliefs and so on, with something like Tibetan Buddhism or Sufism, which is the result of centuries of intense, you know, exploration and philosophical speculation that in many ways resembles scientific approach, you know, developing methods, techniques, keeping records, passing them to the next generation and so on. So, for example, Western psychiatry tends not to differentiate between some kind of primitive folk beliefs and something like the best systems of yoga or Taoism or Tibetan Buddhism. And so it's just all in that one category of the stuff that don't make sense. One major problem that we have in relation to mental disease, particularly psychosis, is that we have a very narrow model. We have a very narrow map of the psyche limited to postnatal biography. And anything that cannot be reasonably explained from the dynamics in the individual unconscious and cannot be interpreted in terms of postnatal biography is attributed to some kind of unknown pathology yet to be discovered by future research. Postnatal biography means our history from the time where we were born, after we were born. Freud talked about the newborn as being tabula rasa. There is really nothing there. It's like a clean slate, and we become what our family history shapes us as, which means what kind of mother we had, what the nursing was like, toilet training, the different psychosexual traumas, how we handled the Oedipal or the Electra problems, as Freud called it, and so on. So the idea is if the person is showing some symptoms that cannot be reasonably accounted for by problems in this individual postnatal history, then we suspect or we actually are convinced that there had to be some kind of a pathological process that affected the brain, and that this is an artifact, sort of pathological artifact. Now, if we now expand the cartography, which we have to do when we work with non-ordinary state, we'll find out there is not just the postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. There is also the whole record of the prenatal state and what happened there, and then what transpired during the consecutive stages of birth, which could have been anything between an hour and 50 hours, you know, several days. And then there is also this whole transpersonal domain, which involves some karmic influences. There is what we can call archetypal dynamic, the sort of the mythological dimensions of the psyche. So if we see then the psyche as having these kinds of dimensions, then the problem with what we call psychosis becomes very different. And the problem is why some people would have to do 45 minutes of faster breathing to get in touch with these domains in the psyche, or they would have to take 200 micrograms of LSD, whereas for other people, the same kind of contents of the unconscious emerge in the middle of everyday life, where they didn't ask for it, they didn't do anything for it, and maybe even were fighting it. There's a wonderful quote in Les Miserables, Victor Hugo, who says, there's one spectacle which is grander than the ocean, and that's the heavens. And there is one spectacle which is grander than the heavens, and that's the human psyche. The psyche is a mystery, and Jung was aware of that. Existence is mystery. It's not something that could be reduced to circumcision or toilet training or any kind of rational. A rational understanding. In that sense, there is much, you know, we can study scientifically in these experiences, but from another perspective, these experiences reach into domains which ultimately probably will remain a mystery. We have, for example, astrophysical theories, cosmogenetic theories about the origin of the universe. You know, that 15, 20 billion years ago, there was this time when there was just a dimensionless point, and out of that exploded existence, and all the matter in the universe and time and space itself. But if you look at it, it's not a very sober, sort of easily understandable kind of a scientific revelation. You know, it is ultimately a mystery, a lot sort of remains unanswered. We are describing maybe how, but not why. Some of the major questions remained unanswered. You know, the relationship between parapsychology and transpersonal psychology is very interesting because parapsychology is really defined in such a way that it studies phenomena for which the current paradigm does not have a reasonable answer, kind of things that should not be happening, access to information through channels that we cannot define in any way. Now in transpersonal psychology, we have a whole domain which we call transpersonal experiences, and in any type of those experiences, you can get paranormal access to information. I've seen people who would identify with an animal, become that animal, body image and everything, and they get new, deep insights into this life form that goes way beyond anything that they ever studied, that they've seen in the movies and so on. A person becoming an eagle and suddenly understanding how you fly, how you work the air currents, they would have the perception of the world which corresponds to the optical system of the predatory birds, not the optical system of humans. Or they would become a pregnant whale and experience delivery of a pregnant whale and suddenly tell you everything about how it's done, which goes way, way beyond what they know. And it also involves dimensions that you cannot learn about through NOVA programs or, they don't tell you what a whale feels like. They will tell you what it looks like, what it sounds like. But this conveys information which is experiential, where you actually become these different aspects of the universe. It's a whole alternative way of learning about reality, not by observing through the senses and analyzing and synthesizing the information, but by changing consciousness and becoming different aspects of the universe. In the same way, you can have experiences, past life experiences, where you suddenly get absolutely new information about a culture, about its costumes, architecture, weapons, social structure, rituals, and so on. I have just hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of case histories. So once transpersonal psychology is accepted and recognized, you don't need parapsychology as a separate discipline, because that paranormal access to information doesn't happen just through psychometry or telepathy or precognition, but it's a much, much wider phenomenon that applies to any type of the transpersonal experiences. So you would have to either vastly expand parapsychology to include all these other observations, or you just simply talk about transpersonal psychology, and what parapsychology studies just becomes, a part of this new psychology. I had this experience with the clinical work, with psychedelics, with the holotropic breathwork, with people in spiritual emergencies, and then exploring all these different areas cross-culturally where non-ordinary states have been involved. And I came to the conclusion that if you study systematically the observations, the experiences in these states and around these states, like synchronicities and so on, that it's a really major, major paradigm challenge, that the phenomena simply cannot be accounted. We have now the term anomalous phenomena, that they cannot be accounted for by the kind of psychology, psychiatry we have, not even the science we have, which is monistic, materialistic, and that if we study these phenomena systematically, this would lead to a revolution which would be comparable to what the physicists had to go through in the first three decades of the 20th century, moving from Newtonian physics to Einstein, and then from there to quantum relativistic physics. So I think it's a revolution in psychiatry and psychology and science that's really long overdue.